ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Why do individuals and corporations donate to political parties?
These are not ideologically driven donations. When you're giving more or less an equal amount to either side, it begins to look like a donation that is designed to obtain access.
Political donation laws, that conversation a little later. First, the visit of Israel's President Isaac Herzog to Australia is generating intense debate. Demonstrations in Sydney have descended into violence, raising serious questions around police brutality and the erosion of the right to protest. We will cover this in coming weeks. But another international visitor flew under the radar. Richard Hermer KC is the Attorney General of the UK, or more precisely, England and Wales. I spoke to him last week when he briefly visited Australia. A proud member of the Jewish community, while in Sydney he visited Bondi and the city's Great Synagogue to remember those killed and injured in the mass shooting terror attack last December. Attorney General, welcome to Australia. Why is it important for you to visit Bondi and to speak at the Sydney Synagogue?
Well, I'm coming on behalf of the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, and the British government to offer our condolences to the people of Australia and in particular the Jewish community of Australia on the atrocities committed at Bondi Beach on the 14th of December and to kind of express our solidarity.
It was only in October 2025 that the UK experienced an anti-Semitic attack when a man outside a Manchester synagogue rammed a car into pedestrians and attacked them with a knife. Two people died in the attack. So this is something which is familiar to the UK.
I'm addressing later on after we've spoken. I'm going to Bondi and then I'm going to actually make an address at the Great Synagogue here in Sydney. And the events on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar in Manchester, was the last occasion I had to make an address after a terrorist outrage focused on the Jewish community. And so it's with a heavy heart that I'm attending to Sydney. And the second time I've got to make a speech about the evils of anti-Semitism and the fight that both Australia, the United Kingdom and other countries have in addressing anti-Semitism and indeed all forms of intolerance.
You're also meeting a number of politicians and lawyers while you're here, New South Wales Premier and the Federal Attorney General. What message do you have for Australian politicians?
I'm here to not only talk about Bondi and to show our solidarity with Australian politicians here as they work to address anti-Semitism and all forms of intolerance and hatred, but I'm also here to strengthen the enormous bonds that we have as two countries committed to the rule of law and working together with my colleagues here to be out there promoting the rule of law and the international rules-based order, because both your country and my country believe it's overwhelmingly in our interest to be big supporters of it.
Well, let's explore some of those themes around the importance of the rule of law at an international level. Late last year, you confirmed that the UK would comply with its lawful obligations regarding any arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. How do you understand the UK's obligations under international law, especially with respect to the International Criminal Court?
Well, look, I'm not going to get into facts of any kind of individual cases. We as a country, though, the United Kingdom, are solid supporters of the international rules-based order and the institutions of the international rules-based order, which very much includes the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. We were instrumental in the foundings of both, as we were in many international institutions, and we, together with Australia, play key roles in upholding them and promoting them.
And you won't do anything to undermine the ICC?
Certainly not. I was in The Hague in December at the Assembly of State Parties, making plain the United Kingdom's support for the International Criminal Court.
As a former long-time human rights barrister and now Attorney General, how do you see Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank in terms of international law?
The United Kingdom has been very plain in calling out Israel's government's policies in the West Bank and indeed Gaza, as we've been very plain in calling out the terrorist atrocities committed by Hamas on October the 7th.
In July 2023, you said as a human rights barrister, the continued Israeli occupation of the West Bank is unlawful, deeply damaging to Israel, and contrary to the concept of tikkun olam, which is, I guess, an idea of around repairing the world in Hebrew. Do you continue with that view as Attorney General?
The policies of the government in which I serve includes the recognition of Palestine, and so it's kind of consistent with the views that I've always expressed.
And how does the UK understand its obligations under international law when it comes to the sale of weapons to Israel?
Well, one of the steps that the government in which I serve took on coming into power in July 2024 was to take a number of measures which included suspending arms licenses for use in offensive action within Gaza, because that was felt to be compliant with our domestic as well as our international law obligations.
You have said the rule of law is under threat on many fronts. How should the UK respond to the USA when it suggests a takeover of Greenland or seizes the president of Venezuela? To what extent should allies directly call out breaches of international law by their friends?
On Greenland, the Prime Minister was really clear. It's a NATO ally. The only people who can determine the fate of Greenland are the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark. I mean, there are obviously all sorts of challenges at all parts of the world at the moment to the international rules-based order. We are pragmatic in our dealings with nations across the world, but we are pragmatic whilst remaining true to the principle that we believe in international law and we believe in the international rules-based order.
You've said that it's okay for countries to perhaps focus more on the use of statecraft rather than boldly calling out breaches of international law. You said that with respect to the USA.
There's often a temptation at times of kind of crisis or when unexpected events to just kind of call people out. And sometimes that can be absolutely necessary. There are other occasions in which the bigger goal of peace and security and prosperity is better served by not name calling, but through statecraft. Now, none of that is for a second to suggest that you dilute your own principles belief. And as I said, you know, the United Kingdom has a passionate belief in international law and the international rules-based order. How we give expression to that in whether we're criticising a state or not criticising a state will depend upon a range of circumstances, but it will never dilute our underlying principles.
Here in Australia, we're having ongoing debates around protest and free speech. In the UK, pro-Palestine group Palestine Action has been declared a terrorist organisation and banned, primarily because the government says it's engaged in criminal damage, vandalism and trespass at military bases and weapons factories. Now, the group denies many of these allegations and says it's always involved in what it describes as legitimate protest action. It's challenged the banning in the High Court in London, I understand, and we're awaiting a decision. As a former long-time human rights barrister, do you understand the view that banning groups is an attack on the right to protest, on the right to free speech?
Look, I mean, because they're both ongoing criminal cases at the moment, but they're also, as you've alluded to, there's an ongoing case in the Court of Appeal. I really can't go into the facts of any particular case that's before our courts at the moment. What I can say, though, is that in societies in which we live, the obligation of government to protect fundamental rights, which absolutely include the right of protest, the right of freedom of assembly. But sometimes those rights will come up against other rights, which is the obligation of a state to protect groups within it and to, where crimes have been committed, to prosecute crimes. Now, one has to navigate a pathway through what are sometimes conflicting rights. But again, we do it in accordance with principle.
You're listening to a conversation recorded last Friday with Lord Richard Hermer. He's the Attorney General of England and Wales. He was in Sydney on his way to a Commonwealth Law Ministers meeting in Fiji, but his plans abruptly changed and he returned to London on the weekend. Richard Homer comes to his role with an interesting perspective. He was for many years a human rights barrister. He represented Maha El-Ghazouli, the mother of one of the British ISIS fighters known as the Beatles, in a legal case against the Home Office over its decision to share evidence with the USA. He also acted for Shamima Begum, a British woman who travelled to Syria, lived with ISIS and had her citizenship revoked by British authorities, and also for Guantanamo Bay detainee Abu Zubaydah, who has remained in prison without trial for 20 years. I put it to Richard Homer, is there a contradiction in acting for unpopular groups and often very unpopular people and now being the first legal officer of the land?
I don't think there is a conflict. I think whether you're acting as a human rights barrister, which I did for 30 years, or whether you're acting as an attorney general, what you're focused on is upholding the rule of law system. And I don't think there is any kind of inherent tension between a past role as a human rights lawyer and a present role as an attorney general. It's about upholding our domestic law system that we have in the United Kingdom. It's about upholding our role within the international rules-based order. Now, of course, as attorney general, I will sometimes be looking at through a different end of the telescope on particular issues. So when I was a human rights lawyer, for example, I didn't have to examine things through the perspective of protecting society in a national security case, for example. But the essentials, which is protecting this precious system that you have in Australia and we have in Britain, of a rule of law system that flourishes within a democracy, of a rule of law that protects fundamental rights. You know, I was in the system before and I'm still in the system, but this time as Attorney General. And it's, I think, I hope I'm able to do my job as well as I possibly can, not least because of the experience I had at 30 years at the bar.
Indeed, 30 years at the bar. You're not a career politician. Rather, you were appointed upon the election of Keir Starmer to the House of Lords, and thereby that way you became eligible to become Attorney General. You weren't an MP. So do you see yourself as a politician?
Look, I'm passionate about politics. I joined the Labour Party as a youth. I was always extremely political. I never actually wanted to be a politician. It was never my ambition. I was always really interested in contributing to society through law and through human rights law. But I was always, always deeply political. So when I got an offer I was not expecting to be Attorney General, it was truly the honour of my life.
And do you offer to your colleagues legal advice, which is perhaps more robust than colleagues who are very much products of the political system?
Look, I think if you're Attorney General, no matter what your background is, no matter what political party you belong to, your obligation is to give clear legal advice, objective legal advice to the best of your ability. And if sometimes that means requiring speaking truth to power, that's the number one item on the job description.
Richard Homer, KC, Attorney General of the UK, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you very much indeed, Damien.
Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National and available anytime on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Political donations are very much in the news this month as the clock ticks down to new donation changes which kick in later this year. The Australian Electoral Commission has released its latest figures for the 2024-2025 financial year. Two independent candidates challenged Victoria's donation caps in the High Court, and billionaire Clive Palmer announced plans for a legal challenge against new federal political donation laws in Australia's highest court.
The Australian Parliament, in my view, does not have the power to stop members of federal Parliament raising funds to carry out their oath of office in accordance with the High Court ruling on the right of political free speech in Australia. And being able to communicate with Australians, even the limited example that I've given you, the simple act of writing them a letter. Elections must be fair.
Dr. Catherine Williams is the Executive Director of the Centre for Public Integrity. Catherine, you and your colleagues have been analysing the latest Electoral Commission data. What stands out in 2024-2025, which includes the April 2025 federal election, what did the major parties receive as donations in that financial year?
Yes, at the centre we've been working really hard to crunch the numbers that were recently released by the AEC. And what we have found is that in terms of party declared income for the financial year most recently, the Coalition received close to $60 million, Trumpet of Patriots around $55 million, the ALP $47 million, and the Greens around $5 million. And I just note, as I said, it's party declared income. There is separately donor declarations made. There's often a difference between the party declared income and what donors declare. So that will be numbers that we crunch subsequently.
So when it comes to the sources of this spending, you have Clive Palmer, who effectively funded his own party. From what we know at the moment, who were the other significant donors and where did they direct their generosity?
So when we look at the two major parties, the ALP and the Coalition also, what we see is that their top 10 donors in their party declared income really are made up of associated entities. So, for example, with the ALP, the top donor for the last financial year was Labor Holdings. Others are all ALP-associated entities, with the exception of Pratt Holdings, which donated around $2 million.
And when you say other associated entities, trade unions?
Some of them are trade unions, that's right. Some of them are also business forums. Mm-hmm. Different ways that parties are able to earn or generate money, also based on the management of assets they've accumulated over time.
And the Coalition?
And the Coalition, it has a lot of money too coming in from its associated entities, most notably the Cormac Foundation, which donated a significant amount to it again. There are some individuals in the Coalition's top 10 donors. We aren't seeing that in the ALP top 10 donors. When we look at the Greens, we also see the dominance of individual donors. They have only got what we can see as one corporate entity and a union as well.
Advocacy group the Australian Democracy Network has crunched the numbers for donations over the period 2014 to 2025 given by online gaming companies, which they say amounts to $3 million for each of the ALP and the Coalition. Now, the Australian Democracy Network says the stats show donations spike around elections or moments when governments are considering major reforms around stronger consumer protections or advertising. Quote, they may not buy policy, but they do buy access to elected representatives that are not afforded to regular people. Now, Catherine, I understand that your centre, the Centre for Public Integrity, haven't yet crunched the numbers for the 2024-2025 period for the top industry sectors that donate to political parties. I understand that's going to take a little while, but you do have the figures for 1999 to 2024. What are the top industry sectors that donate to political parties?
So what we see over that long period is that there are a number of industries that are dominant. They're industries like the resource and energy sector, the property development sector, pharmaceutical and health sector. We also do see significant donations coming in over that period from the gambling industry. And one point that you made that I think is really an important point is that this research, or the Centre's research and the Australian Democracy Network's research too, shows that these donations often are divided more or less equally between the major parties. And this is really what goes to what the purpose of the donations are. These are not ideologically driven donations. When you're giving more or less an equal amount to either side, it begins to look like a donation that is designed to obtain access. And we know that it does obtain that access. There's no doubt about that. There was a really interesting excerpt in a Senate Select Committee report into the influence of political donations from around 2018 when Woodside was asked to provide evidence on notice to the committee about precisely what it gets in exchange for its platinum membership of the major party forums. And the list, it's really enlightening to read. So for the Liberal Party's Australian Business Network subscription, they were getting two places at each state federal parliamentary briefing. They were getting two places at each boardroom policy forum, two places at budget night dinner, and two places at two prime ministers' networking dinners. This is when the coalition was in government. And the ALP opposition at the time, in exchange for subscription to their Labor Business Forum, was giving them access to two policy briefing sessions, tickets to leader events, four tickets to their budget reply dinner, two tickets to Labor Business Exchange Program, five tickets to the end of year drinks with the opposition leader, as well as tickets to the Federal Labor Business Forum boardroom events. So really specifically, it is access that the payment of these subscriptions, donations, enables.
Okay, Catherine, new laws come into effect in July. Very briefly, what are the key features of that legislation?
It's a really difficult question to answer briefly, Damien, but I'll do my best for you. So there are some transparency reforms that look like better disclosure of political donations, and that, from my perspective, is the real win in the legislation. We also see a reduced donation disclosure threshold. So it's gone from around $17,300 in this financial year. It will be $5,000 from the 1st of July this year when the legislation comes into effect. Not that simple, right? There's a longer story there we can elaborate on later. We also see the introduction of donations caps, expenditure caps, and significant changes to public funding. But as with all significant democratic reform legislation, the devil is in the detail, and the detail is very concerning.
Okay, what's your view of this legislation, which was passed by both the ALP and the Coalition?
Our view of this legislation is that fundamentally it addresses the problem that the ALP perceived as its problem. That was the Palmer problem. It also addressed the problem of the so-called Teals from the Coalition's perspective, the main problem. But it fails to address the problem that so many Australians are so deeply concerned about, that's undermining public trust, and that is the ability of moneyed interests to buy access and therefore influence.
There are a number of legal challenges to electoral laws and electoral funding laws. Clive Palmer's just announced that he's going to challenge the laws in the High Court. Tell me, what's he planning?
So Clive Palmer is planning a challenge in the way that Rex Patrick and Zoe Daniel are.
Two former independents.
That's right. On the basis that these laws impermissibly burden the implied freedom of political communication. And this follows a launch of a Victorian challenge in the High Court as well, on the same basis, but in respect to the Victorian laws.
Okay, so what specifically are Clive Palmer and also Zoe Daniel and Rex Patrick alleging is in those laws which impinges on their implied freedom of political communication?
As we understand it, Clive Palmer's challenge is to the public funding aspects of the legislation. And the public funding aspects of the legislation are really significant because we see an increase in the dollar per vote funding. We also see the introduction of administrative assistance funding that is available to political parties and parliamentarians, but it's deeply flawed in its model, and it does appear to advantage incumbents, and particularly major party incumbents, at the expense of the ability of new entrants to compete.
And what about Melissa Lowe and Patrick Hopper? They are two Victorian independent candidates. What's the basis of their challenge to Victorian laws? Again, and these went to the High Court and was heard by the High Court for 2 days.
The Lowe and Hopper challenge relates to the nominated entity provisions of Victorian law, and nominated entities at first appeared in Victoria. We've subsequently seen them appear in South Australia and now also at the federal level. What they are entities that in Victoria only the parties have access to, and by virtue of the fact that only the major parties had significant assets invested in these entities at the time that the laws were passed, only they have them. So Labor in Victoria has the Labor Services and Holdings Trust. The Liberal Party in Victoria has the Cormac Foundation, and the National Party has something called Pillywinks. Nobody else has a nominated entity in Victoria. And the deeply problematic thing is that in a state where there are donations caps, no expenditure caps, these entities are able to pay unlimited amounts of money into the parties. And it's our view that we saw the impact of reforms of this particular kind at the most recent Victorian election, where we lost any independents that were sitting in the parliament. And in essence, it became impossible for them to compete.
So it'll be very interesting to see how these challenges go. Do you have a view about how likely they are of success?
It's our view that the challenges have a very, very strong chance of success, both if we look at the substance and the process of the passage of these forms of legislation. We would predict that the court will be deeply concerned about them. We already know that caps, restrictions on the making of donations, the restrictions on expenditure do constitute a burden on the implied freedom. The question is whether that burden is legitimate and proportionate. And previously, it has been held to be so for, in particular cases like the McCloy case in New South Wales.
That was about property developers.
That was about ban on property developers. That's right. But then we saw in the unions cases that the halving in New South Wales of the cap on how much third-party campaigners are able to spend was found to be unconstitutional, and the issue wasn't the existence of the cap in itself. It was the fact that the parliament didn't have any evidence before it to justify the level at which the cap was set when it passed the law. That was the fundamental problem there. And certainly the federal parliament had no evidence before it when it was setting the level of the caps that have recently been passed.
It'll be very interesting to see what happens with these three cases. But before I let you go, very briefly, what do you argue would make for a better system?
At its most basic level, we think there are some important fixes to be made to the legislation in its current form if it survives. These are particularly around aggregation, because at the moment you've got a situation where a donor can donate $50,000 to every branch of a party. So if you're a major party, you've got 9 branches, your state, territory and federal branches, it's $450,000 annually that's able to be donated. Does that touch the size of the problem of corporate influence? No. So the issue of aggregation needs to be dealt with also from a disclosure of donations perspective, because a donor could make donations of $4,999 in every jurisdiction and avoid the declaration of the donations. So aggregation is a really important point. We would also like to see the expenditure cap lowered. It's $90 million. We suggest it should be around $60 million with an uplift in the per division spend, currently set at $800,000, which we know is too low for new entrants to be able to compete from what we see based on previous spending by new entrants.
Per division, per seat, is that?
Per electoral division. We would like to see it lifted from $800,000 to around $1.2 million, because we know that that's been in recent times the amount of money that successful new entrants appear to need to spend in order to win seats. So we want to see a lift in that, a reduction in the overall spending cap, and we'd like to see the establishment of an independent commission dedicated to dealing with these critical issues of electoral reform.
And look, realistically, the only way any of these issues are going to come up is if there is a successful High Court challenge. That's the reality here, because this legislation is brand new.
I share that view, Damien. I think that the High Court now offers the best chance of redressing the inequality that these reforms will create.
Dr. Catherine Williams, Executive Director of the Centre for Public Integrity. Thank you. Thanks for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks so much, Damien.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Angie Grant. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.